who said the BBC felt that some of its articles had been wrongly hidden. BBC News.
This is BBC Radio 4. Now here's Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, with an omnibus edition of her new history of our changing relationship with plants. Plants from roots to riches.
What is Kew's star plant? Among the contenders has to be the Amazonian water lily, Victoria Amazonica. It's enormous, 10 feet across, sitting in its own specially built pool in the glasshouse, and strong enough to support the weight of a medium-sized child. Its flowers are huge, colourful and highly scented. Lara Jewett has the job of teasing this aquatic beauty into flower every year.
It's just the most amazing annual there is. What other annuals do you grow that produce 40 to 50 leaves 2.5 metres across in one season?
Aside from the sheer size and appearance of these succulent upturned lily pads, the flowers themselves are a real draw. They're a mix of pinks and whites, and those colours are symbolic of a unique pollination mechanism that this lily has become famous for, turning from female into male in 24 hours.
So it has these very large white flowers to start with, and they open in the evening, and they have a sort of smell of pineapple, and they also heat up as well. And this invites a beetle to come and pollinate it, and the flower closes around it. And then once the flower is pollinated, the second night the flower opens, it's now kind of pink in colour, it's lost its smell of pineapple, and it has turned to male. And so the beetle picks up the pollen and then it goes off to the next flower.
And for the Victorians, it was more than just the plant. The adventure of finding it, bringing it to England and getting it to grow involved horticultural ambition, scientific vision, a passion for the exotic and fierce competition among the wealthiest landowners. Historian Kate Cahoon.
The lily was originally described in the early years of the 19th century, and people were delighted, transported by the descriptions. But it never came back to England, and in fact it was lost. It wasn't till 1837 when Robert Schomburgk, the great plant collector, was paddling down a river in Demerara, and he saw it, what he described as a titanic water plant. And he was absolutely overwhelmed by its loveliness. He sent seeds back to England, to Hooker here at Kew, and to a number of other people. And then the race was on to germinate those seeds and to see who could make it flower.
It was to prove a spectacular piece of theatre played out in the fierce light of the nation's greenhouses. For 6 years, getting the water lily to grow defeated all British collectors and their head gardeners. The plant grew here at Kew but refused to flower. Meanwhile, in Derbyshire, the Duke of Devonshire employed a gardener who was soon to become a household name, Joseph Paxton. He was given the freedom to indulge his passions in all aspects of horticulture, including the brand new and very exclusive science of glasshouse construction. The Duke sent Paxton to Kew to obtain seeds of the lily from Kew's director, William Hooker, and bring them back to Chatsworth. Paxton, far more than just a horticulturalist, was willing to do anything to make it flower. And the Duke, just as importantly, was willing to pay for it.
Well, the thing about Paxton was that he really did understand that to make plants flower, you needed to understand where they had come from. So what he had already understood was that he needed to create an environment for this lily where the water would be kept in motion by small wheels, where it would be heated by, he put pipes running underneath the soil in the bottom of the water tanks, where it would be fed, I think he fed it using sewage. And a number of plants people announced that their seedlings were growing. But by the time it came to November, the nights were closing in, it was getting colder. The seedlings here at Kew started to fail, as did everybody else's. And I think Paxton fully expected his to as well. And he wrote, Paxton was supposed to be going to Ireland, but he asked the Duke if he could stay behind. And in early November, he wrote to him and said, there's a bud and it's rising out of the water. And he described that it began to open and the pink tinge began to spread from the centre out to the edges of the petal.
So what was the trick then? What was the difference between Chatsworth and...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you have to assume there's a certain amount of luck as well as love yes. in all of these yeah. things. Yeah. You know, it's mostly... It is understanding. It's getting it right. The heat, the light, the ventilation, the water movement, the nutrition, all of those sorts of things. But then it's kind of luck.
Paxton had won... both in the showy contest to get this hothouse exotic to bloom and also in the silent, subtle contest between the lily's power of growth and his own powers of care and control. As the fame of his flowering lily spread, it proved a triumph for Paxton. And he knew it, as his letter to William Hooker at Kew shows.
Dear Sir William, Victoria Regina is now in full flower at Chatsworth, and will continue, I should think, for a fortnight or longer, as there is a constant succession of buds coming up. Most likely your plants are showing by this time. If not, the sight of this plant is worth a journey of 1,000 miles. We have leaves nearly 5 feet in diameter, and at this time are 13 leaves upon the plant.
He was great at getting the word out. He conceived the idea, coincidentally, when the Illustrated London News drawer was there at Chatsworth, of putting his 7-year-old daughter Annie onto the leaf to
brave.
Show. Well, yes, I suppose he was ready to jump in and save her if anything went wrong, but he wanted to show that the leaf braced very strongly on its underside by a network of ribs with cross girders, if you like, going between them, was extraordinarily resilient, that it spread its load across its entire surface, yeah. Because this had implications for his own thinking about glass design.
The lily's natural engineering was just the sort of thing to excite and inspire the inquiring Victorians. Even in its native tributaries of the Amazon, explorers had admired and noted its extraordinary technology. Richard Spruce, the British botanist, referred to the leaf's strange fabric of cast iron, as though it had just been taken from the furnace. Back in England, others made the connection between nature's designs and what could be achieved with the new technologies of glass and iron. It was becoming possible to build structures of majestic size in which light, heat and water could be scientifically controlled. So far, the biggest and best glasshouse had been Paxton's at the Duke of Devonshire's very private province of Chatsworth, where the Great Conservatory had used the largest panes of glass ever seen.
It was a feat because it had to look beautiful. It was a feat because it was enormous. It was a feat because it provided horticultural theatre, in effect, a place to house exotics from all around the world. In fact, when Darwin went to see it, he said that it was more like tropical nature than he had ever thought humanly possible. But it was also a feat in a number of sort of silent or private ways. So the boilers are all hidden and out of sight. The chimneys, which took the, obviously from which the smoke and the steam came, were hidden at Chatsworth, way up the hill, just much as they were here in the Palm House at Kew. And there was a series of tunnels through which the coal trucks could be shuttled to feed the boilers so that you wouldn't see them from the house. So this great, beautiful house that Bess of Hardwick had built up in Derbyshire, you could look out from the windows and you wouldn't see hundreds of minions
scurrying,
sort of scurrying around with their coal wheelbarrows.
Here at Kew, the iconic glasshouse, the Palm House, was completed in 1848. It's the closest we can get today to imagining what Chatsworth's Great Conservatory must have been like. Designed by Erasmus Burton and Richard Turner, it triumphed Chatsworth at 110 metres long and 30 metres high. If you look at the image on our website, you can see that it looks like an upturned hull of a gigantic ship. It was, after all, the shipping industry which had pioneered the use of cast and wrought iron in making these iconic arches and allowing even bigger curved roof structures to be created. And one plant, big enough and important enough to get its own glasshouse just across the lawn from here, was the gigantic lily, as Greg Redwood, head of glasshouses at Kew, explains.
The structure of the building is quite interesting because of the trusses. The big circular wrought iron spandrels are typical of Richard Turner. This was another progression in the fact that at the time it was the largest single-span glasshouse in the world, and the whole building is just built to enclose a 30-foot pool to grow Victoria Amazonica in. The pool itself has heating pipes in to keep the water nice and warm, and we grow this plant as an annual. We sow it in a seed in January or February. When we get to about 4 or 5 leaves, we plant it out in May sometime. Unfortunately, because of the way the plant grows, by October or so, the main rhizome sticks
sticks out of the water and it dies. It's got to be one of the fastest growing plants we grow. The really nice thing for us working here is that you can come here in the evening when it's dark, and that's when the water lily smells. It doesn't smell during the day. So I will come down here at night and let myself in and smell the water lily, although I don't get into the pool because the leaves and stems are covered with evil spines, so that's not a good idea.
We walk into these structures and they're, aren't they? They're resiliently Victorian.
Oh, yes.
But for the Victorians, they were extraordinarily modern. They were yet more example that they were living in times which were changing really fast, where progress was everything, new technologies, and that seeps right down, not just in terms of factories and factory acts and politics, but right down to the plants in our gardens.
As the demand for greenhouses increased, so did the need for the simplest, lightest and most economical system for building the roof. Once again, Joseph Paxton is in the lead. In his lily house for Chatsworth in 1850, Paxton reaches the height of his creativity.
He's developed his very own system. It's called ridge and furrow roofing, which is an odd system of zigzag roofing, if you like, which puts the panes of glass literally in sort of pyramidical form. And that minimises light when it's right overhead and maximises it when it's low in the mornings and the evenings. Very good for the plants. And he's realised that this form of ridge and furrow roofing allows him to create spans greater than any glass roof spans at that time in England. And what Paxton realises by the late 1840s when he builds the Lily House is that the combination of his ridge and furrow structure and what he's learned from the lily leaf, in fact, about the sort of bracing cross girders underneath, which spread the load, is that he can create these spans almost entirely flat. In fact, nobody had ever thought of it, but actually it's much stronger and cheaper. And so that's what he does for the Lily House. And it's that design, ultimately, only a year later, that allows him to design and then build the Crystal Palace, which is then not just the greatest glass building the world's ever seen, but probably the greatest glass building the world will ever see.
By borrowing engineering and design from nature, the Victorians had created a building which both housed nature and imitated it. But the lily's spectacular power, with its exacting requirements, was also a reminder of nature's potential ability to defeat all human enterprise. Other plants arriving at Kew from the furthest corners of the globe were beginning to hint at huge commercial potential. Would it ever be possible to build and maintain a whole new industry on exotic plants from abroad?
Tapping into rubber.
What links lettuce, car tyres, dandelions and a smuggled consignment of 70,000 tree seeds? The answer is rubber. Not many discoveries can genuinely be said to have changed the world. This one did. Without it, your daily life would be wetter, noisier, more dangerous. And for the English at least, it all started here at Kew. Natural rubber derived from latex had long been a curiosity, a soft springy substance that magically reformed its shape. As early as 1734, it had been noticed by a French explorer, Condamine, as a substance for waterproofing dwellings by the Amazonian Indians, just the sort of thing to inspire the new breed of scientific entrepreneur such as Nelson Goodyear, who'd sprung out of the white heat of the Industrial Revolution. In 1839, he discovered that by heating rubber with sulphur and lead, a process known as vulcanisation, it stayed flexible even in extreme cold and heat. It was still rubber, but not as previously known. The potential for rubber now seemed endless. At the Great Exhibition of 1851, Goodyear displayed many wonders and curiosities made from this strange natural substance by his new method. So did Mackintosh, a Glaswegian chemist who greatly improved the quality of rubberized fabric by sandwiching a layer of rubber between two layers of cloth, leading, of course, to the fashion accessory of the time, a Mackintosh rubberized raincoat. Items from the Great Exhibition are now kept here in the Economic Botany Collection at Kew, where Mark Nesbitt is the curator.
Here we've got jewellery made by Goodyear. And what you can see is these are, in fact, demonstration pieces. We've got chains here to show that, you know, with rubber, you can make complicated moving things. This beautiful brooch of deer, where the rubber has flowed through the antlers to be cast into a brooch.
I love the earrings. They're particularly nice.
Yes.
They look like they're sort of a knot that's been tied. Presumably it was rubber that then was formed into a knot and then placed on an earring. Fantastic.
And what you'll notice is that all of these rubber objects are black, and these are hard. You can see that they were made to be hard at the time of use. That's because these are heavily vulcanized. And this kind of rubber is called ebonite because of its resemblance to ebony.
So these are very glamorous. What were the less glamorous parts of the vulcanization process and rubber that came through from that?
The less glamorous objects are, in a way, the more important in a collection. So we're looking here at four sort of greyish rubber rings, nicely packed in an acid-free box. And these are gaskets, so to go in between iron or steel pipes. If you think the main source of power in the 19th century, by the time rubber comes along, is steam. And so when you have steam flowing through pipes, every time pipes join each other, you have to have a rubber gasket. So there are all kinds of mundane but extremely important industrial uses for rubber.
Central to the spread of new ideas and intellectual curiosity was Prince Albert. His support for the Great Exhibition gave it the official seal of approval. The story goes that he and Queen Victoria were stopped in their tracks at the Mackintosh stand and presented with a tablet of vulcanized rubber, engraved upon which was Charity, a religious poem by the popular hymn writer William Cowper.
The band of commerce was designed to associate all the branches of mankind, and if a boundless plenty be the robe, trade is the golden girdle of the globe. Each climate needs what other climes produce, and offers something to the general use.
It was a brilliant PR exercise, and significantly, the poem captured the moment. God had placed his natural riches in abundance all around the world, and trading them by whatever means for the common good was a noble endeavour. But as so often with the sudden exploitation of a natural resource, there was a problem. Demand was beginning to outstrip supply of wild rubber. Bolivia, Brazil and Peru had experienced a boom in the rubber trade. The botanist Richard Spruce had made a solitary trip through the Amazon region in the 1850s. He'd seen reckless destruction of thousands of trees through indiscriminate slashing and overtapping for rubber trees for latex. Something had to be done. A report commissioned by the India Office in 1871 recommended that Britain generate and maintain its own stocks of rubber in India, and to do this by taking one of the most high-yielding rubber species, Hevea brasiliensis, from South America and growing it like a crop in plantations in India. Kew was to be the central cog in this transfer process. It was to get the species from South America to the colonies. After all, there were good precedents for this sort of approach. Kew already had success in getting quinine out of South America and cultivating it to ease the British conquests of India in the face of malaria. So the question was, could a similar success be achieved with rubber? Enter Henry Wickham.
I'm probably alone among British planters and forestry men, having also had working experience with rubber in the native forest, and therefrom know the natural habitat and requirement of these trees.
Henry Wickham, a restless wanderer, one-time coffee planter and trader in bird skins in the Amazon. Could Wickham be our man in the Brazilian jungle? His boastful travel diaries and his attempts at botanical drawings certainly persuaded the India Office at least, and they instructed Kew's director Joseph Hooker to look upon him favourably. Historian Emma Rice.
We don't have the text of Hooker's reply, but it seems to have been pretty terse to judge by Hooker's notes. From his point of view, Wickham was unqualified with no botanical expertise, no horticultural expertise, the son of a solicitor, not a person of great social status, somebody getting up to who knows what in the Amazon. And on top of all that, he had the temerity to ask to be paid.
Hooker was notoriously sensitive to status, especially his own. Wickham, a mere travelling adventurer, was demanding more money than a gentleman botanist would expect to live on. Hooker dismissed the request out of hand, but by 1873, the price of rubber had outstripped the price of silver. Supplies were at a premium. The situation was rapidly becoming urgent. The India Office contacted Hooker again, this time with some alarm.
Suddenly, Joseph Hooker was more than willing to paint Henry Wickham as Kew and his best friend. He wrote to say, "I have a correspondent in Santa Rema upon the Amazons who is engaged on the business of rubber collection," very much giving the impression that this was something he had planned all along.
And your offer of £10 per 1,000 seeds is sufficiently liberal, but it will only be adequate if a considerable volume of seeds is to be purchased.
So it's clear that both Wickham and Hooker were aware of the economic imperative for rubber production, but Hooker also knew that failure would come at a heavy price. Richard Spruce had almost died of malaria in pursuit of cinchona, and neither Kew nor the Indian Office had any wish to lose a botanist unnecessarily in the equally dangerous pursuit of rubber. But Kew was also taking a big risk with Wickham. His horticultural skills, let alone his botanical credentials, were thin. So why is Kew putting all its faith in this man? Jim Endersby explains.
They're still trying to prove their value to the nation and to the empire to ensure their continued funding. But I think perhaps the other model for botany is what's been going on with geology. Geology has become a much more prestigious and important science, partly because it has demonstrated its ability to predict where you should dig for gold. And there's been a gold rush in Australia in the middle of the century, built on a prediction by a leading British geologist. And I think that botanists get a gleam in their eye. They can see the possibility that properly worked out science of plant geography, of acclimatization and transplantation, all of these things will come together into an ability to find new sources of plant wealth for the empire, to demonstrate their value to the empire, but also to demonstrate their power as a proper science able to make predictions.
With commission in hand then, Henry Wickham, according to his colourful memoir, would have us believe that he crated up 70,000 seeds and in the face of armed customs officers at Para, declared his crates to be carrying
exceedingly delicate botanical specimens specially designated for delivery to Her Britannic Majesty's own royal garden at Kew.
His apparent subterfuge worked, and it was full steam ahead for England before the delicate seeds perished.
Fatally, it's said that the letter of commission was meant to refer to varble or living seeds, but that was left out. That's very important in the Wickham story.
So 70,000 seeds came back to Kew,
of which 4% germinated, 4%? Less than 2,500, yes.
Goodness, why so few?
Well, there's evidence that Wickham was collecting seeds over quite a long period, despite knowing that rubber seeds don't live for very long. If they dry out, they die. But once you have seedlings, you can start to take cuttings, and then you can multiply up the number of plants. And then the seedlings were sent to botanic gardens all over the world, in fact, not only to the British Empire.
So, in effect, Kew was acting as the clearinghouse. The seeds were coming in, they were then developing them, they were creating seedlings, then sending them out to all these other countries.
Well, it was much more than just plants going in and out. What the founders of modern Kew understood is two things, really. One, that if you know the name of the plant, you already start to know its properties. You start to be able to get a handle on all of its diverse uses. But also, if you look at it in its ecological context of where does it grow, you can then predict where it can be successfully grown in other places. So, for example, the Brazilian rubber tree, Herbea brasiliensis, grows in the Amazon. So if you're looking for a climatic analogue, you're looking for somewhere that's hot and wet, which takes you, in the case of Britain, to the Far East, to India, to Burma, to Malaysia.
Using Wickham's apparently smuggled seeds, Malaya built up its rubber plantations, and by 1910, they overtook Brazil. The key figure in Malay's success was Henry Ridley, director of Singapore Botanic Garden. Mad Rubber Ridley, as he was known, would enthusiastically press rubber seeds into the palms of any district official, and it was he who developed a new method of tapping latex which preserved the productive life of rubber trees. Brazil, meanwhile, would go on to prosper with another plant it had acquired from overseas, coffee. However, it wasn't only rubber that was reflecting the commercial and political importance of plants at this point in time. The passion for plant products across the globe was also extending to their cultural value. And as we'll hear, affordable exotic beauties that up to now had defied expertise were igniting Victorian desires on home soil. And this would usher in a new era of cultivation for all.
Orchid mania.
Thank you. They come in an infinite variety of shapes, smells and sizes. They can make themselves look like a bee, smell of vanilla, pretend to be a fungus, or produce extraordinary flowers exactly the right size and shape for a moth with a 10-inch tongue. Small wonder, then, that the annual Orchid Festival at Kew is one of its most popular public events. Emma Townsend, a tour leader at the festival, is well aware of the appeal of the orchid family.
It has this fantastic, exotic, sometimes it's sexual connotation to the flower. Some people just want to go and look at the incredibly colourful kind of vandas. They're hanging down
from the blousy ones.
Yes. And for some people, just to put their face up to an orchid and smell in that perfume, you just can see that their day has really been changed.
Orchids are big business. Over £5 million worth of orchids are imported as cut flowers into the UK each year. You can find luridly coloured cloned hybrids in the flower section on the shelves of your local supermarket, and vanilla pods in the baking section. At the same time, because it's such a varied family, some of the stranger examples are extremely rare and precious. The earliest orchids arrived on British shores in 1731, and by the Victorian era had become a true botanical celebrity. James Bateman published his gigantic book on the orchids of Mexico and Guatemala in 1843, lavishly illustrated and full of travellers' tales and tips on cultivation. Bateman called orchids the chosen ornaments of royalty, neatly capturing the allure of the potent mixture of imperial conquest and scientific discovery. By the mid-19th century, Britain and the rest of Europe were in the grip of orchid mania. But as historian Jim Endersby explains, like other manifestations of Western imperialism, the results were far from benign for the local population.
There's a vivid and rather distressing example of this when Joseph Hooker is travelling in India in the 1840s. He actually writes home to tell his father, William, that he has witnessed orchid collecting on a kind of grand scale, to the extent that the area looks as though a hurricane has blown through it, with twigs on the ground, the trees devastated by the collectors. And the collectors in question are actually working for the Calcutta Botanic Gardens. And these are, you know, obviously now we think of Botanic Gardens as being at the forefront of plant conservation worldwide, Kew in particular. In the 19th century, they're inadvertently contributing to the destruction of orchids on a grand scale. And, if the Botanic Gardens seem a little reprehensible, the commercial collectors are 10 times worse. I've come across accounts of people talking about cutting down over 1,000 trees in order to get the orchids that are growing at the top of them, felling great swathes of a rainforest in order to find orchids. And other cases where very rare orchids are discovered by a collector, they collect as many as they can carry and then deliberately destroy as many of the remaining ones as possible to stop other collectors finding them. So there is a kind of orchid holocaust almost going on at this time because of this European lust for these exotic tropical flowers.
As the Victorian writer Charlotte M. Young commented in 1856, hothouses full of orchids were like
a picture in a dream. One could imagine it a fairyland where no care or grief or weariness could come.
Orchids are now known to be one of the most diverse families of plants. At Kew, we've 3,000 types growing in the nursery, which sounds a lot until you realise that this is little more than 10% of the known species worldwide. And even to house these different varieties, 6,500 square metres of glasshouse is needed and 21 different climate zones, from hot and humid to cold and dry, all carefully controlled under the management of Lara Jewett. And the number of species just keeps growing.
We're definitely finding new ones all the time, especially in countries that we haven't been into. So my colleague's recently been to Cambodia and they've collected and described a lot there. Obviously, they have to be described before we know that they're new. So that's one way they come in. They come in as seed from other collections. And then when we flower them, we realise that they're brand new and the botanists will come and name them. And so that's very exciting. And then the last way is that if any orchids are brought into Heathrow illegally,
they'll come to Kew to be looked after while that case goes to court. So potentially they could be new species and quite often are. That's why they have been collected illegally.
So we've got this fantastic diversity of orchids, both here at Kew and obviously in the world. What's it, 25,000 species?
Yeah, but what's really interesting is how important they are in the areas that they grow. There's the gongora, for example, it's from Brazil. And it's pollinated by the euglossum bee. Now, the euglossum bee goes to it to get a fragrance from it, and that fragrance attracts the female euglossum bee, so it's like an aftershave, if you like.
It's extraordinary. I mean, people think about insects doing this, don't they? But they never think about plants having a scent for other pollinators.
But what's really interesting is that it's the female bee that pollinates the Brazil nut. So it's that relationship. Without that orchid, you know, they wouldn't mate, that wouldn't go on, and then that nut wouldn't be produced.
What makes orchids so successful as a family, their ability to adapt to many different environments, also makes individual species highly vulnerable to sudden changes in their local environment. Many are confined to a tiny area of just a few square metres or less. Each maintains a precarious foothold. Madagascar contains the greatest concentration of orchid species anywhere in the world. Many of them are at risk. At Kew, conservation efforts are now underway to collect the seeds of these rare and threatened species and to cultivate and reintroduce them into the wild. Viswanbaram Saracen is head of conservation biotechnology at Kew.
In the area we are working, it is the Central Highlands that covers almost 40% of Madagascar's land mass. This area is very, very difficult to get to collect orchids, but at the same time, the problems are illegal mining, slash and burn agriculture. People illegally collect orchids from the wild.
So that's still going on then, there's plant hunters.
So there are multitudes of threats to these orchids in the wild. Say, for example, we have seen species where only two or three plants left in the wild, then there may be only two or three seed pods to collect. We don't collect all the seed pods, so we're forced to collect only one seed pod.
Right.
And just leave the rest for...
So very, very precious then, that one seed pod when you bring it back.
Exactly, exactly.
Successful cultivation from a few seeds can be achieved by micropropagation or growing in miniature. The collected seed pods are sterilised and sown onto the surface of a nutrient medium. With the correct temperature, light and moisture, the seeds can germinate within a few weeks. As Saracen explains, however, their research shows that effective cultivation of orchid seed also requires an understanding of its close relationship with fungi in the soil.
Orchid seeds in nature need a fungus for its germination. So that early stage is being helped by a mycorrhizal fungus.
So these are the fungus that grow around the roots system.
Exactly. What actually happens in the wild, once the mature seeds are dispersed, so it needs to find the right fungus for its germination.
What's the fungus supplying the plant with then?
Because the orchid seeds don't have an endosperm, that is a feeding tissue for the germinating embryo, the fungus come in as a sort of a feeding supporter, helping the seed to get the necessary nutrients. So what we do now is when we go and collect the seed capsules, we also collect mature roots of the same orchid. And then we bring the roots here. Then we isolate these fungal coils inside the roots and then culture them.
Have you got some examples in here then of orchids grown with and without the fungi?
Exactly. What we are looking here is, you know, one same orchid species which we collected from the wild with fully mature seeds.
So these are what, 5 centimetres across these little plastic
plates.
Pots?
Yeah.
And then they've got agar, is it agar gel inside
it
there?
Is,
That's your medium.
Yeah, it is a medium.
And one where you've got fairly vibrant looking little seedlings, and
exactly.
One where they've...
Only two then.
Two looking rather weedy, I have
exactly.
to say.
Actually, it is all the magic of the fungus, basically. So huge difference between
Massive.
Them. And also the quality of the plants.
So if you're thinking about restoring them in the wild, you absolutely need to have mycorrhizae in there to have a successful restoration of these orchids.
Exactly. We are producing these sort of symbiotic seedlings for a large-scale reintroduction or restoration work back to the wild. And when we go after 6 months or something, these plants should be still there, growing, happy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, whatever work we do wouldn't be complete.
So we have a paradox.
This is the largest family of plants in the world that has beguiled millions of people over the centuries, but is also one of the most endangered. Interestingly, one of the most invasive species in the tropical rainforest is in fact an orchid. And it is this ability of this family to prosper anywhere that highlights a problem too, and one of which the Victorians in particular were becoming acutely aware: the impact on native plants by a growing population of newcomers, alien invasive species.
Plant invaders.
The effortless movement of plants and seeds around the world during the late 19th century, such a proudly celebrated achievement by the Victorians, was having an unwanted side effect: invasives, plant immigrants. With no natural predators to control them on new soil, one man's flower was turning into another man's weed.
Some of the most aggressive invasives can be introduced to a very small area and then explode, out competing for nutrients or for light, crowding out things, and so can lead to species decline and species extinction.
If an introduced plant becomes disruptive to the native flora in its new location, then this is when it's known as an invasive. Some of our most notorious invasives have become only too familiar. Japanese knotweed is a well-known pain for most gardeners in the UK and has no natural predators. Giant hogweed is another one, a huge triffid-like monster from the Caucasus Mountains. The term invasive plant has rightly come to have some very dark connotations. The naturalist Charles Darwin was one of the first to discuss invasives. At many of his island stops on board the Beagle, he noticed and lamented that in some cases, invaders had replaced previously dominant native plants. Historian Jim Endersby has been looking at Darwin's diaries on this matter.
When he arrives in St Helena, he points out that deforestation is already quite extensive and that alien species can hardly have failed to destroy some of the native kinds. So this is already something he's very conscious of quite early on in the voyage. And it's with these ideas in mind, I think, that he reaches the Galapagos and begins to notice how intense the struggle for existence is in an island.
St Helena, situated so remote from any continent in the midst of a great ocean and possessing a unique flora, was a little world within itself which excites our curiosity.
But the island, he felt, was now in a sterile condition with limited flora compared with what it must once have held.
I believe that there is not any account extant of the vegetation when the island was covered with trees. It is not improbable that even in the present day, similar changes may be in progress.
But why did some species flourish in a foreign habitat and not others? Joseph Hooker, as explorer and botanist, became very interested in this question, not least because he was one of the people responsible for unwittingly introducing one of our most notorious invasives, one with gorgeous flowers and an insatiable thirst for land, probably currently marauding through a landscape near you.
Hooker's own rhododendrons from the Himalaya, which are published at his father's instigation in a beautiful illustrated book, create something of a rhododendron craze in Britain in the 1840s and 50s. They become very popular garden plants. And we now have large parts of England overrun with rhododendrons that have escaped from people's gardens and have grown into impenetrable thickets and have choked out native vegetation in many parts of the country. So it's something of an irony that Hooker, who was one of the first botanists to really think about the impact of invasives, should himself have been at least slightly responsible for a major invasion of Britain.
Many of today's worst weeds started out as deliberate introductions. The very things that made them such spectacular trophy plants in gardens, their huge size, exotic flowers and vast leaves, also appears to have made them the perfect invaders. It's an uncomfortable irony that plant hunters, botanic gardens and nurseries played a major role in introducing some pretty troublesome plants. And once the invasive is out of its box, there's no putting it back. One of the top 10 invaders globally is Lantana. We know it in Britain as a beautiful ornamental pot plant and shrub. It's a native of South America and was brought to Europe by Dutch explorers and cultivated across the world for its colourful flowers. It was introduced into Kolkata as a flowering hedge to beautify the Indian countryside around the 1800s. Now it's widespread in India, South Africa and Australia and is a real problem plant. Because in the right climate, it grows in dense thickets the size of a small tree, blocking out light to any other plants around and preventing cattle from grazing. As plant ecologist Shonal Bhagwat of the Open University explains, its edible appeal is part of its weapon.
It produces very delicious, tasty berries. As a child, I used to go and collect those berries and get my hands red and black with the colour of those berries.
Did you eat the berries?
Yeah, they are delicious, actually. They you can make marmalade or jam out of them.
Out of lantana.
And, I mean, it's no surprise why birds like bulbuls in India feed on the berries. But that also means that these birds disperse berries and the seeds of lantana well beyond where they feed on them. And that's what happened with the first introductions from botanical gardens. Soon it was everywhere.
Once again, the botanic garden is the villain of the piece. Indian foresters realised as early as 1870 that with such effective seed dispersal and lack of any natural predator to halt its progress, lantana was sweeping all before it. Indian forest reports across the southern half of the country bear witness to its rapid spread over the next few decades.
A forest officer called Jayadev in the Nilgiri Forest Division mentions about lantana. He says it has taken possession of the ground in dense impenetrable thickets in young teak plantations. Management will also include uprootal of lantana over the entire plantation area. So an incredible effort was spent in really just pulling this plant out from the forest where it had invaded. Despite everything that has been thrown at this plant, nothing has actually worked, and this plant is still spreading everywhere.
Oceanic islands are even more vulnerable to invasion by non-native plants. Many are full of endemic species and classified as biodiversity hotspots. Kew conservation biologist Colin Clubb specialises in monitoring plant communities on islands and the impact of new arrivals.
One of the unique plants on Ascension is the Ascension Island parsley fern, Anagramma ascensionis. And this was first discovered and described by Joseph Hooker when he visited the island in 1843. And I've got in front of me here Hooker's original herbarium specimen of a number of examples that he collected there. The culprit for the parsley fern's demise is a species of maidenhair fern. People will be familiar with that. It's a common pot plant, Adiantum. And this particular species is Adiantum capillus veneris. What's interesting is that Hooker never mentioned this particular species, and it would have been known to him. It's quite a well-known species of fern. So we think that sometime it was introduced, and it was probably one of those vicarious things. It came in as a spore attached to something else, and it obviously got to Ascension and liked the conditions there. And it's a bit of a thug. It's very tolerant of varying moisture conditions. So you find it in the dry, exposed volcanic cinders, but then also in these wet seeps, which is the habitat for the parsley fern up on Green Mountain. And what we're observing there is that the maidenhair fern is really aggressively filling all those niches.
The annual surveys declared the parsley fern extinct in 2003. Then, in 2009, it reappeared.
We surveyed around and actually did find four individuals finally on this very precipitous cliff up in Green Mountain. Very, very exciting. So we collected a couple of fronds into sterile petri dishes, and then we got that back here into micropropagation. And our colleagues in the conservation biotechnology unit here at Kew have managed to then grow that and taken it right through to adult plants. And that, and in fact I've got in front of me here a specimen from that ex situ cultivation down in microprop, which we can compare with Hooker's specimen and satisfy ourselves that this is indeed, we're dealing with the same plant. And in fact, we can produce now the parsley fern in micropropagation in large numbers. But there's no point of reintroducing a species back in the wild unless you've actually sorted out the very situation that caused the demise of that species. In this case, it's these invasive ferns. So one of the things we're doing now experimentally is beginning to do some clearance small-scale clearance of this fern to try and develop a suitable habitat for the parsley fern as a self-sustaining population in the wild. I think we're going to have these conservation interventions all the time, so actually using horticultural skills in the field to try and maintain the balance, and active intervention if we see that the invasives are overwhelming the situation.
So whether we like it or not, alien species have and will always have a place in our landscape. Understanding this is vital. It will help resolve some, though not all, of the problems which invasive plants cause. And looking at what's happened on Ascension Island may provide insights into our attitudes and approaches.
It's actually a kind of artificial cloud forest there now. So a novel ecosystem and a combination of non-native and native, invasive and naturalised species. And certainly now, with potential and suggested impacts of climate change and looking at resilience of combinations of plants in particular habitats, it may be that we have to think of non-natives in a slightly different context and not just as the enemies, particularly in habitat restoration and species reintroduction, but also recognising the role and the function that some of these non-native plants can offer.
The struggle faced by Kew and the island's conservationists to bring the parsley fern back from the brink of extinction shows just how difficult it is to strike a balance between natives and incomers. New plant species are still being identified at a rate of 2,000 per year, so as yet unknown botanical troublemakers may be poised for invasion. In fact, we've yet to resolve the mystery of what makes plants succeed in particular locations, a point which Charles Darwin was pondering back in 1844.
Many plants seem made to live everywhere, and others nowhere but where they seem to have been generated.
Darwin's friend Joseph Hooker wondered if it would ever be possible to predict potential culprits. It's a question scientists are addressing today, thanks to the science that at the start of the 20th century was to transform botany. Genetics.
Patterns from crossed peas.
In the spring of 1900, three papers by three botanists unknown to each other appeared in the same volume of the Proceedings of the German Botanical Society. The first by Hugo de Vries, the second by Karl Korenz, and the third by Erik von Schirmack. Each had independently rediscovered the rules of inheritance that Gregor Mendel, a once obscure monk, had found 40 years earlier in his solitary investigations of pea plants. Mendel's original paper in 1866 may not have attracted much attention, but these did. Today they are credited not only with rescuing Mendel from oblivion, but also with launching the science that would soon come to be called genetics. The century of the gene had begun. Like many iconic figures, the Mendel we know is part man, part myth. Wisdom has it that he was a simple, uneducated Austrian monk, obscure in his lifetime, who, while playing around with simple pea plants, accidentally discovered the basic laws of modern genetics. And his breakthrough was ignored because he was cut off from the scientific world of his day. That's the myth, but little of this is true. Here's historian Jim Endersby to straighten the Mendel record.
Strictly speaking, Mendel wasn't Austrian. He was German, German-speaking Moravian. He wasn't actually, strictly speaking, a monk. He was an Augustinian, so he's a friar. He was not a simple, uneducated man. He had a degree from the University of Vienna and was trained by some of the leading scientists of his day in advanced mathematics and experimental design. So he actually had a really good grasp on state-of-the-art science. And we can see from reading his papers that his experiments were very carefully designed and that he grew so many plants in order to make sure he had statistically valid, accurate results to talk to. But the bigger problem is that Mendel wasn't looking for the laws of genetics. He comes out of a tradition of German plant breeding of people like Gärtner and Kohlreuther and so on. And what they're interested in is hybridizing to improve the varieties of plants. And the great problem when you hybridize is reversion. You cross two varieties, each of which has a quality that is attractive or interesting to you as a grower, and you get a nice cross, And then unfortunately, when you plant the seeds of that cross in the next generation, the old unimproved variety starts popping up in among the good ones. And so your valuable crop is mixed up with the old sort that you were trying to improve. And it's that problem of why hybrids revert to the ancestral types. That's what Mendel is really attacking.
His experiments are well known today. He observed a variety of traits of pea plants, including height, smoothness of seed and colour. He then cross-pollinated individuals and kept careful records of which characteristics were passed on. For example, taking colour, he crossed plants which produced yellow peas with those producing green. He then replicated the experiment a vast number of times to eliminate mere chance effect. But when his first generation of hybrids flowered and bore fruit, the results stunned him.
Every single pea is yellow. The green has just disappeared. Where's it gone? And now he then gathers these yellow peas from this first generation, plants those, waits for them to grow, and then opens their pods and looks again. The green is back, but not in every plant. There's a predictable ratio about this. As he counts these thousands of plants, 10,000 plants he mentions in one of his experiments, it turns out that there are three times as many yellow peas as green peas. And this is a predictable ratio with every single trait that he experiments with, 3-1 every time.
Mendel concluded that there must be three types of pea, pure breeding yellow, pure breeding green, and a mixture, the scourge of the hybridist, which although its peas came out yellow, could still produce green peas in the next generation. It looked on the face of it as if Mendel's experiments may have shown what plant breeders had known for decades, that behind all the maths, most hybrids return to their parental form. But Mendel had gone into the problem systematically. Thanks to him, science now had mathematical laws governing hybridization. Not only that, but by 1900, the scientific understanding of cells and chromosomes was now giving Mendel's ideas a physical reality. As historian Greg Raddick explains, biology had changed in ways that made Mendel's paper come to life.
The topic of heredity and related to that variation had emerged not just as a vital scientific subject in its own right, but as something which could be investigated experimentally. And that's where hybridization came in. Hybridization emerged to a number of observers as an especially perspicuous way of uncovering the laws that govern heredity, that govern the rendering of offspring as like their parents. And it was above all Charles Darwin and his work on evolution, which had magnetized attention along those lines. And there is a hunger among biologists for some kind of mastering theory, which will help them make sense, they hope, of the great range of new results, experimental results, statistical results, to do with heredity and to do with variation.
For the esteemed biologist William Bateson, Mendel's work provided exactly what was needed to close an ongoing debate about heredity and the environment. Bateson believed that changes in traits occurred by sudden leaps within one generation, so-called discontinuous variation, rather than gradual changes as proposed by Darwin. Mendel's emphasis on cleaning distinct either-or characters, green or yellow, round or wrinkled, was a good match for Bateson's ideas. The story goes that Bateson read Mendel's paper on a train on the way to give a lecture at the Royal Horticultural Society. He immediately rewrote his lecture there and then so he could publicly hail Mendel's work and achievement. Life might still be a game of chance, but the rules of the game were now an exact science. Bateson became one of Mendel's most effective champions. His audiences were spellbound. Plant breeders, too, were quick to spot the potential of this new science. If preserving the best characteristics of a crop from one generation to another was now science, not luck, then Mendelism could be a powerful tool in maximising output and profit. Whilst Bateson spread the word, the first professor in agricultural botany at Cambridge, Roland Biffin, put it into practice.
Bateson was telling his audience about Biffin's successes in uncovering Mendelian characters in wheat. So characters which, like the seed shapes that Mendel had investigated, where he'd found roundedness and wrinkledness and how these changed over time, with some characters being dominant and others being recessive. According to Bateson, Biffen was uncovering exactly these kinds of characters in wheat. And what that meant, Bateson said, was that in a short time, breeders would be like chemists in the power that they would wield over their materials. That in just the way that chemists were able to plug elements in and out of compounds at will because they understood the atomic nature of chemistry, so breeders, understanding the atomic nature of inheritance, and that was an analogy that he prized, would be able to plug characters, hereditary characters, in and out of hybrid organisms. And this wouldn't take forever, as it did in the bad olden days, said Bateson. It was something that could be done almost instantaneously thanks to Mendelian thinking.
From 1900 to 1925, under the watchful eye of Roland Biffen, a string of new wheat varieties were rapidly produced. Biffen was partly driven by a belief that Mendelians such as himself and farmers could work together to turn around Britain's depressed wheat industry. The aim was to fight back against the so-called grain invasion from America and Canada, cheap wheat that was flooding the UK market, if they had access to new, stronger hybrids. He'd studied patterns of disease resistance in wheat and noticed how closely the distribution of disease and resistance to it followed the classic pattern of Mendelian inheritance. He was convinced that he could now replicate this in transferring strength from American to British wheat. Biffen assembled his collection of the crop from around the world, ready to start his hybridization experiments. Mark Nesbitt, you're curator of the Economic Botany Collection here at Kew, and we're here in the herbarium, and you've laid out in front of us here some examples of Biffen's success.
So we see here one of his best-known wheats, Yeoman, developed in 1916. And this is the result of deliberate hybridization of wheats, which had already been practiced by plant breeders since the mid-19th century. But plant breeders had real difficulty in understanding or handling the offspring that came from those crosses. They ended up with fields of very diverse wheats, very hard to interpret, hard to use in breeding. Roland Biffen, because of his knowledge of Mendelian genetics, was able to measure the offspring of his crosses and then interpret the results in terms of the underlying genetics. This made his breeding much faster and much more predictable. So Yeoman wheat, which had in fact Red Fife, one of his early farmer selections, as one of its parents, was a great success, and it really was one of the major wheats in production for the next 50 years or so.
Designing, controlling and manipulating of plant traits was to become a science in its own right. Through the work of Bateson and others, botany had become botanical science. Going forwards, this was the century of the gene. Botanists would start to peer into the internal workings of plants, their cells and chromosomes. Manipulation of plant shape and form to improve crops, wealth and human well-being was the scientific aim. And as we'll hear, an endeavour laden with possibilities, but also controversies.
Plants from Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Kathy Willis. The readers were Clive Hayward, Ian Redford and Jane Slaven. The producer was Adrian Washburn. To find out more about the plants featured in the series, go to the website, where you can also download the series as a podcast. Lurching through the door of Radio 4 Extra's Comedy Club now is Count Arthur Strong. Here on Radio 4, it's The World Tonight in a few moments after a quick look at tomorrow's weather. Outbreaks of occasionally heavy rain will spread across England and Wales, but some dry, clear spells will develop too. Much of Northern Ireland and southern and western Scotland will stay dry tomorrow. It will be windy though, with gales for some exposed western areas. And there'll be rain or showers for many of us during Sunday, particularly in the south and west. On FM, on long wave, on digital radio and online, this is BBC Radio 4.